Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. So nice to see everybody here today. Some new faces here today, new people here for the first time. And been doing this meditation class now. I've been doing it for about a year, I guess. Started in October. And, different people come. Sometimes people come for a while. Sometimes they go. Sometimes people stay for a while. Sometimes they don't stay. And it's all kind of up to the people, you know. People like to come, then they can come. If people don't like to come, they don't have to come. And I don't check attendance. And I was talking with a friend of mine the other day about these kind of things, because the way that it kind of works with meditation and with Buddhism, it's something that nobody can do for us, right? You can't. It's not really possible for me to reach into people's minds and be like, okay, I'm going to train your mind to be this way, you know? Kind of get rid of your unwholesome qualities for you. Yeah? In a sense, this is something that we all do on our own. We kind of all have these kind of abilities to make intentions. And we make an intention like this, we make a decision, we take an action. What that creates is it creates a kind of momentum in our mind. You know, so this is why the Buddha says, he says intention, what they call chetana, intention, that's what they call kamma, karma. You know? So in the West, you kind of have these phrases, kind of catchphrases, something good happens, that's my good kamma. Something bad happens, that's my bad kamma, right? There is a kind of truth to that. This is part of the way that kamma works. Because although kamma means intention, what results when we have an intention, intention is the cause. We have a kind of intention, and that's like setting a ball in motion. Right? You kind of set a ball rolling in motion. Now, if we push a ball from the top of the hill, then it's going to go really, really fast. Kind of go down the hill and continue for a long time. And if we push a ball at the bottom of the hill, it might roll up for a little while and come back at us. Yeah. So this kind of intention is the beginning point. It's the beginning point in what starts a causal chain. It's the beginning point in what starts a momentum. But after we put an action into place, there's all kinds of things outside that can push it to the left, push it to the right, push it up, push it down, push it right out of the park, right? Or push it faster, push it faster away from us, you know? And so this is something that kind of Western science really emphasizes. This kind of, you might call, kind of a Newtonian aspect of kamma. Not to get too scientific. I myself haven't taken any science classes since high school. But just basically this kind of idea, in modern physics, these kind of billiard balls, right? Kind of you got a pool table and you hit your white ball with so much force and it hits the next ball. And if you hit it, you can calculate with math the right angles that it will hit, and it'll kind of go into socket X, Y, Z, whatever kind of pocket you're trying to aim it into, right? And so this is, in a sense, kamma does have this aspect to it, right? If we set an action in motion, if we set it rolling, then if we can kind of guess, in the future, we'll have these kind of other results from that, as long as we keep that action rolling, then those results will come to bear fruit. And we can see this in our kind of lives all the time. Kind of this is why parents, when they're young, I have a kind of young cousin who's now going into high school. And whenever I see, sometimes see him and his mother's always kind of a, on his case to get studying, kind of getting the homework done, and testing him out. Sometimes I'll go to, if I'm down in that area, I'll go to visit them at their house, and if I stop by the house and they're kind of, she'll be like quizzing him on like some geography or something. And it's because they have this aspect in mind, it's kind of billiard ball effect of karma. Like, look, if you put these proper causes into place, if you put the right effort into place, you'll get good grades in high school, you get good grades in high school, you'll get good grades in, you'll have the skills needed to get good grades in university. If you get good grades in university, then you'll have the skills needed to get a good job and you'll make enough money to support yourself and be at ease, right? And so this is the kind of planning that people have to do in their life all the time, right? Have to plan what kind of, for a layperson, how much money do I have in the bank so that I can pay the bills for next month? This is an aspect of karma, aspect of cause and effect, right? How much gas do I have in my car to get from this point to the next point? This is a kind of aspect of karma. We're putting a kind of cause into place and getting an effect. But where sometimes in the West, what gets forgotten about the Buddhist teachings about karma, or not, I shouldn't say what gets forgotten about the Buddhist teachings about karma, but what gets forgotten in the West, sometimes at least for myself growing up, was that there is this moral aspect to karma. So there isn't just this billiard ball approach. It's not that the world is just a billiard table in a complete air vacuum. It's more like we're trying to shoot billiard balls, but every day we shoot them, one day we might be in the middle of the forest with all kinds of roots. Shoot the billiard balls, not just a straight line, it's going over roots. And another time there might be a ramp. Another time we might be at the top of the hill. Another time we might be at the bottom of the hill. And all these different kind of effects are in place that can change the course, the trajectory of the action that we want, of the result that we want. So in the Buddhist teaching, what he tends to teach us about is, there is this aspect, when we want a particular effect to come into place, we try to put the results in for that. But there is also this, what we would call, more mysterious kind of aspect to it. So I know nowadays, I had a friend of a friend who I knew in high school, and he was reading all these kind of books about the law of attraction, so actually I'd never heard about this law of attraction, and I was living at a monastery one time, and I used to go on walks with the guests there. It was kind of like to get out and walk, and was talking to one of the guests, and he was like, "So what do you think about the law of attraction?" And I thought he was talking about, like, people with similar personalities get along. And I was like, oh, yeah, people with similar personalities get along. But only later did I realize he was talking about, I guess, this phenomena that happened for a while. I don't know if it's still going. People really interested in this idea that if you just think about something, then you mysteriously pull the causes for it into place. Kind of mysteriously, all the various elements of this kind of thing come together, get you what you want. So in this vein, I actually had a friend who was reading a lot of books about this and moved out to BC, just kind of on a whim, just like got on a plane and or a friend of a friend. Yeah, I think he's still there now from what I hear. Maybe things working out. But there is also this aspect of what we might call law of attraction aspect of karma in Buddhism. There is also this aspect that although we might really want something to happen, in the front of our mind, there are aspects in the back of our mind that can pull us away from it. Aspects subconsciously that can pull us away from it. There's kind of very mysterious things like that happening in the mind, kind of many different things going on. And so this aspect, this attractive aspect of the mind, this aspect that pulls us subconsciously towards good things in our life and propels us away from bad things, this is what comes from making what we call good karma, doing good and wholesome things. Yeah? So actually some of these things are actually kind of counterintuitive. The good karma that leads to beauty, this is what people tend to want in the world, right? Kind of, and it's important. People have like this kind of a beautiful face and they go in for a job interview. I remember reading when I was in school, it's like 50% of your chance of getting a job is based on your, you know, like your physical appearance. And then the other 50 is based on your skills. Anyways, this is the way that people look at things in the world, you know? And people desiring to have this kind of beautiful physical appearance. The interesting thing about it, the kama that inclines our mind towards beautiful physical appearance is not getting angry. And whatever somebody says to us, we don't respond. We have this mind of altruistic joy, this mind of goodwill towards everybody. And cultivating this kind of mind of goodwill, people sleep really well. Kind of these intentions that come up, they brighten a person's complexion, their skin looks really good. And when they die, after death, their mind reaches out. It grabs onto a form, like a physical form, that's quite pretty. Yeah? Either they've done that in that life or another life. But the interesting thing about this is that what do we see with really beautiful people? They tend to be really angry people. not all the time, of course, but you know, these models, like, you know, you heard people, like, sometimes they have this nefariously terrible temper. I remember there was this one model when I was young, and she was like a supermodel, you know, that's like normal level of model. They've got one level up where you're like super, and she was on the super level, and she had this nefariously terrible temper, would just flip out on everybody, and could get away with it, because she was pretty, and, you know, people listened to her. But the interesting thing about this is that acquiring this kind of good kama, in acquiring that, sometimes the desire for it, what we think of when we want this good kama, in eating it up and consuming it, we lose the very thing that led us to it. It kind of pulls us away, pulls us in on itself. And in a similar vein, the good kama that inclines our mind towards wealth, this is another thing many people want, is actually generosity, kind of giving things away, giving away wealth. So what inclines our minds to situations, what the Buddha calls inclines our minds towards enjoying, they call the five strings of sensual pleasure. So there's this actually story, this interesting story in the canon. There was this really rich kind of financier, kind of, you know, like a Wall Street type in the Buddha's day, kind of money lender. He was extremely rich. And when he died, there was, you know, the king was there with the Buddha, I think, and they saw these kind of carts going by just filled with money on their way to the royal treasury, you know, on the way to deposit this money with the king. And it was because this guy had died without an heir, and the king said to the Buddha, he's like, you know, it's amazing, this guy was so rich, but he traveled around in this, like, crappy, dilapidated cart, and his food was like, you know, pickle brine, and he wore these clothes with like these terrible like rag balls like hanging off of them. His clothes were rags, but he was so incredibly rich. And so the Buddha said, you know, well, this man, you know, in a previous life, what he did was he gave alms to a private Buddha, one of these Buddhas who get enlightened on their own. But after he gave it, he wished, oh, I should have given that away to my servants. And so because of that, his mind inclined towards getting wealth, but didn't incline towards enjoying it. So there's a lot of interesting things that happen in these laws of attractions here, because when we give wealth away, our mind inclines towards wealth, our mind inclines towards the enjoyment of wealth. But what do we see happens when people get really wealthy? When people get really wealthy, they sometimes also get really stingy. So it's actually funny, some of the, if you go on alms round in some of the poorest areas in Thailand, I know, the people will come out, they're very happy and like elated to see monks, and you can barely like walk through a street without having to empty your bowl because it's full of food. People just want to give away their food. And with their neighbors, they want to give to them. They want to invite them over to dinner. They want to interact with them. They have no choice, right? They can't drive in a Rolls Royce. This is all they can get. If they don't get that, if they were just stingy and miserable towards each other, they would be totally sunk in misery without any material possessions. They have no choice but to cultivate these aspects that lead towards wealth, interestingly enough. But then you go for alms or pindapat in a very rich area, and sometimes you'll get like almost nothing. Although these people are extremely wealthy, driving Rolls Royces, driving around in Benz, having houses with 20, 30 rooms or whatever it is, lots of servants. And of course, there is a kind of reason to this. I mean, if you're very wealthy, people come up and ask you for things all the time. You have to find ways to protect your wealth. But the point of this is that the interesting thing in that getting this wealth undermines the very quality, the very law of attraction that led to get it in the first place. And so this is one of the aspects, the interesting things about what actually causes what we might call pain in Buddhism, what we might call suffering, or it gets called dukkha in Buddhism, is that the very things that we love have this ability to turn on us and bite us. The very things that we love have the ability, when we consume them, they lead to their ending. Yeah? We consume a bag of chips, it disappears. We consume our wealth, it disappears. When we go on that big vacation we worked for so long to go on, we're not working to make more money. You know? And so we get caught up in this because the end result always seems so tantalizing, right? That vacation always seems so tantalizing. But the interesting thing, that next Twinkie, right, always seems so tantalizing, right? That next promotion always seems so tantalizing. The next reward, the next grandchild, the next child always seems so tantalizing. But the interesting thing is when we really pay attention to these things, you know, if we really watch, the next time we get the big Twinkie and we're about to bite into it, where is our mind? Right? It's not on the Twinkie. Our mind is gone. It's somewhere else. So what we often really pay for in this looking for reward is these moments of peace. when we're consuming the Twinkie, our mind is gone. We're not thinking about our worries. We're not thinking about the past. We're not thinking about the future. We're not even thinking about the Twinkie. It's just we're blotted out by this feeling of happiness or pleasure that comes from it, and usually our mind is off somewhere else, reminiscing about something else. Same thing with a vacation. Yeah? We're on a vacation. You know, I've been on a bunch of vacations. Sometimes people go on vacations and looking forward to it for so long, and they get there and they're like, this food is terrible. Paid so much money for this food. It's too hot out. The air conditioning is too cold. This pool has too many people in it. And they go on the vacation and complain. And then when they leave their vacation, they go back to work and they're thinking about their next vacation. It's the same thing with promotions. Want this big promotion at work. If I just got this promotion, I'd be happy. And then we get the promotion and it's not too long, maybe a year, before we start to notice some of the drawbacks of this new position that we have. And our mind launches out to the next promotion. If I just got this, I'd be happy. So in modern psychology, they've noticed this, and it's basically this thing that people people can be, not all the time, very poor judges when looking back in memory of what it actually is that makes them happy, what it actually is that brings them peace. And this is the aspect of Buddhism that the Buddha called tanha, or craving. This craving is what leads us on to constantly desire what we don't have. You know, constantly run away from what we do have, never being satisfied. And the thing about this craving is it never ends. It's based on these kind of things. It's based on it can be based on this miscalculation. If I just get this vacation, I'll be happy. If I just get this Twinkie, I'll be happy. It can be based on some faulty memories. When I had that Twinkie, I was happy. When I had that vacation, I was happy. When I was 10 and I was running around playing, I was happy. When this person who used to be in my life is no longer there, was there, I was happy. You know? And we forget about all the other things that were going on in our life at that time. We forget about the pool with too many people. We forget about too much heat. We forget about the poor quality service at the restaurant. And our mind is off again to the next thing we have to consume. So the Buddha's solution to this is actually kind of counterintuitive and is one of the reasons why people in the early days of Buddhism, when it first came to the West, when Westerners first encountered it, they thought it was pessimistic. Because it was always pointing out, look, in these things that we think we love, there's this potential for pain. There's this kind of potential for suffering. You know? in these things that we want to consume, you know, in the vacations we want to consume, in getting the wealth, we undermine our ability to get it, to keep it, in consuming it. In getting our power, we develop the kind of law of attraction to lose it when we consume it. You know? In getting beauty, sometimes the things we want with beauty, in consuming those things, we develop the law of attraction to lose our beauty. You know? In this way, the world spins around on itself, spins around in what the Buddha calls the eight worldly winds, running towards gain, running away from loss, running towards pleasure, running away from pain, running towards fame, running away from anonymity, running towards status, running away from loss of status. And this is what the world can revolve on for a person's entire life. So instead, the Buddha has us change our perceptions of these things. Change our perceptions that the path to happiness is getting more gain, getting more status, getting more fame, getting more more of these kind of things, kind of Twinkies and whatnot, right? Instead, he turns us in to look for more stable and secure sources of happiness inside. He points us out, there is this kind of actions that we can do, actions that bring forth results. When we practice generosity, that makes us happy. When we practice restraining from doing bad things, restraining in the five precepts, that makes us happy. When we practice meditation, these things make us happy. The paradox of them is, these things are also the same things that incline our minds towards gain, incline our minds towards status, incline our minds towards fame. So he teaches us further, when these things arise in our life, when gain arises in our life, don't get obsessed with it. Think to ourselves, this good fortune has arisen for me now, how can I use it to develop more wholesome qualities, right? Not, now this good fortune is here, this is who I really am, right? I'm somebody who's got the promotion, I'm somebody who's got the Twinkie, right? I'm somebody who's got the fame, you know? How can we now use this kind of, if we have wealth, how can we use this wealth to develop wholesome qualities, qualities of mind? And then he has us take these things further to develop these qualities into meditation, to try to find a source of refuge inside, so that we can learn to find a source of happiness that doesn't even depend on Twinkies, doesn't depend on external things, just more or less depends on us having the ability to focus on our breath, having the ability to focus on spreading thoughts of goodwill, having the ability to train our minds. And these are things that are much more stable than the winds that blow us around. And then finally, he has us turn our minds even on these things. Even these things, these types of happiness, they arise from a cause, like a billiard ball. They arise from shooting the ball down the lane, and eventually it bumps into this next ball, and we get this as a result. You know? So eventually, the path that the Buddha teaches actually turns inwards even on the path itself. Even on his own teachings itself, these things too are impermanent. To try to find a happiness that isn't dependent on conditions, isn't dependent on cause and effect, isn't dependent on karma, isn't dependent on anything at all. And this is the ultimate aim of the Buddha's teachings. It's why he teaches us to meditate. It's why he teaches us to practice giving. It's why he teaches us to practice morality. It's for the sake of actually finding something that really does provide the happiness we're seeking. Not the Twinkie, not the gains, not the offerings, not the fame, but something that's truly independent, a happiness that doesn't change. And this is the purpose of our Buddhist practice, to find something beyond karma.